Simon Chama is the author of many notable books, including A History of Britain and The Power of Art, both of which accompanied acclaimed BBC television documentaries, which he hosted. His latest book, The American Future, A History, is the companion volume to a four-part television documentary that was aired this past January. In it, he connects contemporary feelings about war, democracy, immigration, and prosperity with people and events from our history. It's published by Echo Press, and I'm very pleased that Simon Chama, who is a professor of history and art history at Columbia University, has returned to our show. Hi.
Well, thank you for having me in your media palace.
Yes, yeah, you've never seen these studios.
No, what happened to my beloved Gothic ruin? I'm talking about the building.
We've escaped.
Apparently.
Why did you choose to begin this book and the TV documentary in Iowa on the night of the caucuses?
Well, that was the moment that all my expectations that the election was going to be about something rather than nothing in the Jerry Seinfeld sense. Nothing meaning simply mutual character assassination, endless television spin, but about something, namely the destiny of the American Republic at a very tough moment in its history. That's when I really felt, not by sort of seeing the crowds at the Obama party that night, but by talking to our crew driver, for example, who said, I've never seen the country in such a bad shape. So I felt that expectation, which is sort of catnip to a historian, that this was going to be an election of substance, was actually coming true.
And you say that it was impregnated with history, but what would have happened if Barack Obama had lost the election, or even more, if he had lost the Democratic primaries? Wouldn't that have forced this whole thing to have turned out quite differently? Would you still have written many of the things that you've put into this book?
I was putting my hunches out there, the very thing a historian is sort of forbidden from doing usually by a Hippocratic oath, only because you have to talk about what actually did happen. On the other hand, I suppose you'd say that history became so big in terms of the financial meltdown in October of last year, that whoever would have been given the poison chalice would have had to step up to history's plate if that had been Sarah Palin. I tell you, Leonard, I think actually something would have demoralized me, irrespective of who would have been the nominee or the victor, and that was all those expectations about elections essentially being about spin, the legacy of Lee Atwater and Roger Ailes, and Obama said would have been vindicated. And Obama said something very powerful, I thought, in the acceptance speech at Denver. He said, you know, big elections can be made small. He said, it's worked. It's happened before. And I think the Stephen Schmidt at the beginning of the general election campaign said this is not going to be a campaign about issues. It's going to be a referendum on character, believing that Obama's so-called inexperience would not really stand up to John McCain's genuinely heroic resume. But he was so wrong about that. It did indeed turn out to be the mightiest issue election of all. So I'm glad for the, it sounds sanctimonious, but I'm glad for the fate of American democracy that this was indeed an election about history and wither America.
Well, but Obama was also aided by a number of different things. First of all, he handled himself quite well. Nobody expected him to do that well in the debates. Right. There were a lot of people who felt he won all the debates.
I didn't, actually. Not with Hillary. I thought Hillary cleaned his clock towards the
end. Well, that may be. I'm talking about the McCain debates.
The McCain debates.
Where it came down to that character issue you're talking about. On top of it all, Americans were, by that time, really unhappy with Iraq. And, as you say, the economy was in serious trouble. So it's interesting that Michael Steele is quoted in the Today's Times, the chairman of the RNC, saying, the era of apologizing for Republican mistakes of the past is officially over. The era of Republican navel-gazing, done.
I love that, isn't it? It's nothing like, you know, seizing the reins of history. If you declare something, it must be true. It reminds me of a favorite moment from a historical movie, which you're much too young to have seen, called Sword of Florence, when a third-rate British actor pretending to be Michelangelo rides into a pasteboard version of the Piazza del Duomo and says, men of Florence, the Renaissance is here. So, you know, if you say it, it's going to be true. Well, dream on, Michael Steele, because it's not his to decide whether the era of apologizing is over. It's called A Matter for the Electorate.
But you also argued that certain ideals were made visible during the 2008 election and Obama's victory. America discovered that it stands for earnest democracy, transparency, freedom, and a government truly of, for, and by the people, a kind of grassroots democracy rejuvenated. But hasn't that been the way all along in varying degrees? Was it all
yes,
that
but the varying degrees can sometimes be interrupted by decades in which government is indeed, as Reagan wanted all of us to believe, the problem, if not the enemy. When the essence of being American, come on, if you and I were to turn onto a different radio station as we're talking now, we'd hear a notion, a version of American history which says it's all about the self-respect of the individual. It's about the optimizing of individual energies, and that's what makes America. You'd hear that echo of what, after all, was a kind of Jefferson creed, really. On the other hand, all I did indeed want to say is that when Obama, and I think for me, I don't know about how you feel about it, when I went out and talked to people in places that don't normally vote Democratic, like Indiana and Oklahoma, they always brought Katrina up. They always said, Iraq, it's a torment, but we honor our troops, but our stomachs were turned when we saw those bodies bobbing in the slick. And when we saw one, I remember a military family said to me, never mind about you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. What we hated was the president flying over the scene of disaster. Now, that sort of long tradition of dignified governance actually was always lying there in the world of Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, waiting to be reborn. And Obama would not have succeeded if he hadn't simply resurrected that, something as American as apple pie. So the charge that he was really a European socialist in disguise could not stick.
Although they also were invoking Lincoln and FDR. But you mentioned Jefferson, and in your book you write about current politics through the prism of a debate between Jefferson and Hamilton. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I mean, it's always striking to me and amazing and rather moving that right at the outset of the Republic, these great debates are being fought out about what America might be. Ought the point of America's freedom to be something clean, virginal, new in a world? That was Jefferson's idea. Decontaminate the notion of power. The Atlantic Ocean will do it partly for you by simple virtue of the geopolitical facts. But America's democracy will be democracy of virtuous farmers. And the great rolling acres made a great deal more rolling acres after the Louisiana Purchase would allow America to be something pristine. It would be Periclean Athens or Democratic Athens written on a continental scale. Hamilton said, give me a break, in effect. He probably didn't use exactly those words, but said America's destined to be a power. You better get used to it. It's going to be a power with business, with industry, and it better have a professional army. So that debate really, it's ongoing. It's absolutely eternal because they're genuinely sempiternal philosophical issues.
Although Hamilton seems to have been more of the realist, what was the reaction at the time? I mean, I object to Jefferson partly because he hated cities,
right,
and he didn't recognize that they were a really important part of the development of this country.
It's odd that, isn't it? But he loved cities, providing they were Paris. Something else which is in the American DNA of self-delusion. But no, I think actually at the time you might say it was most fought out in the election actually fought between Adams and Jefferson in 1800. Hamilton is lurking, as he's a great lurker, in the wings then. And Adams sort of distorts it in a way, the famously notorious advertising slogan in 1800, God or Jefferson and no God. Jefferson notoriously failed to acknowledge that Jesus was the Son of God. It would just be a tough election platform to run on now, I think. But at that point, there was a genuine issue about whether you were happy, or as we too often say in America, comfortable with federalist government, with the notion that Washington was going to be a big place, that there was going to be a serious taxing arm, that the Bank of the United States was something we could all feel happy about. And Jefferson's notion, I mean, a genius in a way of saying, whatever ails you, whatever is unhappy, we can just remove all the obstacles to democratic self-realization out there on our farms, all will be well. Well, it's a fine thing for Jefferson to say, because he's having, as I say, slaves doing the schlapping.
Actually, there's a kind of reversal there, because now some of the arguments that Jefferson would have come up with are arguments that Republicans will come up with, and some of the arguments that Hamilton came up with, Democrats will come up
That's
with.
That's absolutely right.
Or Adams,
you could,
anyway.
No, you could indeed say Franklin Roosevelt was a great Hamiltonian. Lyndon Johnson certainly was. And there must be a Jefferson Institute of Advanced Conservative Studies somewhere, I'd thought.
Simon Chama is my guest, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Rough Crossings, an early book about the United States. This one, The American Future, A History, published by Echo, accompanying the television series, which was done with a British audience in mind, wasn't it?
It was, yes. I mean, there were certain things about... I got very slightly irritated, really. Something that rarely happens to me, as you know, Leonard. But with some of the simplicities, really. During the Bush years, nothing was right about America. The endless idle clichés, America the cowboy state, America in the grip of irreversible, brutal militarism, and so on and so on and so on. And one of those cliches, by the way, was really about how American religiosity was entirely exclusively and also irreversibly a creature of the extreme right, really. And
but there's an evangelical movement in England that also seems to be politically connected.
Wow, if you blink, you wouldn't notice it, really. Who do you have in mind?
I speak to people who come from England who talk about how it's growing. Maybe it's
the
just
only really big evangelists are Muslim evangelists, if that's not an oxymoron. Or else maybe I'm not spending enough time there and haven't noticed hot gospeling in Walthamstow, you know. But can't say I haven't noticed. But, you know, I tell you something, though. When grand people, my friends in lofty liberal and not-so-liberal circles, say to me, oh, you American. Americans, you're so religious. I said, well, guess what, actually? America was founded by Presbyterian refugees from British persecution in the 1640s. And what's more, it wasn't so long ago in Britain that all our churches were full in the 19th and early 20th century. The more interesting issue is why Europe, and why Britain in particular, became secular. But I did, when you say I did this for a British audience, I did want to complicate some of those simplicities. Really,
do you think that an American gets something from this insider-outsider perspective that you bring?
People have been asking me that. I'm not presuming to be, you know, baby grandson of Tocqueville, really. I mean, who you'd have to be insane in your
presumptuousness. Well, you spend more time here than Tocqueville.
I have a lot more time than Tocqueville, yes. And, I, you know, it's almost for you to tell me that. I think I do have that. I mean, but it is, oddly enough, since I do bounce from side to side, it's a matter of having two fairly intensely engaged allegiances rather than saying, as I fly over the Sargasso Sea for the umpteenth time, oh, I'm, you know, distance is a wonderful thing and makes me cleverly dispassionate. I'm not sure clever dispassionate is actually a Sharma thing.
One of the major figures in your telling of our history, Montgomery Meigs, somebody I've never heard of, and yet obviously I should have.
Well, I hadn't either. I mean, I think I tell the story in the book, in fact, I'm sure I do, that we were filming on Veterans Day in 2007, Dick Cheney speaking, and I knew that the National Cemetery at Arlington was actually on what had been, you can see it, Arlington House, the grounds of Robert E. Lee's house. And I thought, it was very odd. And obviously there was an act of confiscation somewhere, but who did that? So I asked actually at the desk, and then I went to the website, but the amazingly nice man, tough man, who was a guide, said, oh, he said, you're the first person in years. My hero, he said, Montgomery Meigs. And Meigs, what then jolted me, it was a moment of fantastic serendipity, I discovered that Meigs, who had indeed expropriated the Lee estate, had been a friend of Lee's. They'd both been West Point graduate stars. They'd worked on civil engineering, trying to widen the Mississippi. And I thought, this is extraordinary. Then I found that there was a Montgomery Meigs now teaching at Georgetown, but teaching a course which called, you know, why presidents ought to be careful before they go to war or something. He was a decorated veteran. I thought, this is just a fabulous personal dynastic story through which to tell the story of actually our mixed feelings about American war.
The Meigs family had been connected to the military for all the years intervening.
They were doctors, they were generals or doctors. And Meigs was someone who had done lots of civil engineering. It was he who finished the construction of the Capitol Dome, who built forts up and down America, the aqueduct in Washington. So he was a real Jeffersonian civil engineer. And he was... And not particularly ferocious abolitionist, you would say, but he was aghast at the treason of Lee. He could not believe when Lee was offered command of both armies that Lee chose to be a traitor. And iron entered the soul of Monty Meigs, and he became the quartermaster general. He became the great figure delivering food, uniforms, bandages, without which the Union would not have won the war.
And interestingly, the contemporary General Montgomery Meigs, who was... commander of the stabilization force in Bosnia, right, came out publicly against the invasion of Iraq.
Yes. He and I talked a bit about that, and I think he saw himself because of this long... I think it was sort of whether it's in his family genes or not, but he saw himself as part of that very early Jeffersonian West Point tradition where you have to pay attention to the society in which you're planting your bombs and your artillery. So he thought of himself like George Marshall. He thought of himself as someone who knew that the war was going to be, is not his phrase, mine, the easy bit, and who hated the sort of sense you could do a drive-by war, and that somehow spontaneously Iraqi society would magically and spontaneously reconstruct themselves and the soldiers would be drowning in nosegays.
Part of the problem, it seems to me, that we've faced again and again, and you address in this book and in the TV series, is that we have these very high-flown ideals, and then we have the way we've really acted. We were just talking about torture earlier, a country that has always condemned torture and has always taken the high road, at least theoretically, and been seen itself as that beacon of democracy for the rest of the world to emulate.
But what do we do about that? You don't want to say, at least I don't want to say, the ideals are doomed to be empty shibboleth, actually, and we'd be much better. I suppose Henry Kissinger might say that, to be beady-eyed pragmatists, to be full-on Hamiltonians with no illusions about the world at all. I actually am soppy enough, you know, to think that those ideals are worth cherishing. That is why America is in the world. But the answer is all the things we're hearing from the White House: transparency, honesty. You're never going to get it right. You know, we're going to find this out in Afghanistan, where we have to do a bit of micro-nation building. You're not going to get it right, but you have to be honest and clear-eyed about what you're trying to do.
But then I look at the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your poor, et cetera, and think about the anti-immigration sentiment in this country, a country that has been peopled by mostly immigrants.
Right. It's you know, were the United States of schizophrenia rather than the United States of amnesia, as Gordon Corfitel called us. We're stuck with it. That's who we are. It's the case, as I detail in lamenting detail, that you know, Benjamin Franklin, that good, rugged 18th century figure, was paranoid about what he called the German threat. He thought America, our good Scotch, Irish, English stock, was being threatened by what he called tawny people. Tawny people turn out to be Swedes, rather mysteriously. I don't know which Swedes he was looking at. And the terrible pogroms that were inflicted on the Chinese after they finished building our railroads. All that is, or the failure to open the gates to Jewish refugees after the quota system was put in place in the 1920s. All of that is horrible, but you and I would say, we're two Jews sitting here around this table, another American reality is that bit which made the Statue of Liberty true. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of the destitute and the persecuted for whom the gates were really open between 1880 and 1914. That's America too.
Are you going to write another book on art sometime soon?
Is that a request? I would love to. I would not die a happy man if I didn't.
Simon Sharma is a professor of art history and history at Columbia University, author of numerous books, most recent being Rough Crossings, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. He will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at 82nd Street and Broadway. And you might want to stop by and say hello. Thank you so much for coming by to say hello to us.
Thank you, as always, Leonard.